Okay. So let us continue with the questions. And there is a large number, which is great. It's nice that people engage. That's always good news. So first of all, a couple of things from yesterday. There was someone who asked about the suttas for the Sangaha Vattus. And this is found, as I mentioned yesterday, in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. The fours, which is the fourth chapter, sutta number 32, and it's also in the numerical discourse of chapter 8, the eighth, and number 24, sutta 32 and 24, chapter 4, chapter 8. And it's not a very common thing in the suttas, but it is mentioned like this in a few places. Someone asked about whether we could suggest to buy the book after for the BSAA library. I think it's a good idea, but I would maybe suggest that you suggest that to the librarian yourself. That's probably usually the most direct way of doing it. Otherwise, you never know if it's going to get done. So if you wish to do that, you have my backing. I agree with that. So that's maybe that can be useful. All right, so that is just some leftovers from yesterday. I tried to provide the full service, so you're picking up all the loose ends. So there we are. Okay, so starting from today. So dear Ajahn, since everything is conditioned, where did this self come from? Is self also a product of conditioning? We take rebirth again and again because we did not break through the notion of self. Is that right? Yeah, so the idea of self is itself conditioned. It is just a perception that we have, something we add to our experience. One of the interesting things that the Buddha says in the suttas, he says that there is no beginning to ignorance. Ignorance just goes back, in other words, delusion, misunderstanding of the world. There is no first point to that. It just goes back. So there is no first point to the idea of a self. It has always been there. If it hadn't been there, you wouldn't be reborn. You wouldn't be here anymore. But the sense of self can vary enormously. Sometimes it can be quite strong, like when you have a big ego or whatever. Other times it can be quite weak, like when you practice meditation, you go deep within, and the sense of self almost evaporates, especially when it comes to the deep stages of samadhi and the jhanas. The self is practically gone. In fact, many people would argue it is gone when you go into jhana, because you don't actually have any experience of a self within those states, because there is no reflective ability. There's just a feeling of a very expansive and powerful mind, that's all. But then when you come out of the jhana, you think back, you think, oh yeah, that was myself. That's kind of how it tends to work. So the underlying tendency to the sense of self is still there. This is called the asmiman anusaya in the Pali. It means the underlying tendency to the conceit, I am. Asmi, I am. Mana, conceit. Anusaya, underlying tendency. Asmiman anusaya in Pali. And yes, we take rebirth again and again, precisely because you do not break through that delusion, the notion of a self. That delusion is what carries on, makes the kind of the cycle carry on. As long as you have a sense of self, you will have craving. And craving is what projects you into the future. And even if you don't have any craving in the sensory realm, you will have craving that relates to the sense of self. The sense of self wants to exist. And so you have the craving to exist as a minimum. The bhava tanha. Bhava is existence. Tanha being craving. So you will have the bhava tanha as a minimum. And if you don't have the bhava tanha, you will have the vibhava tanha that someone mentioned the other day. The desire to be annihilated and to stop existing. And that itself is a craving that will keep you being reborn, which is kind of paradoxical. The desire to be annihilated, it is a kind of craving that keeps you getting reborn. So that is how it works. The sense of self gives rise to craving, and that's why it drives the process of rebirth. All right. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, there have been 28 Buddhas, and we have our current Buddha from 2,500 years ago. Will we see another Buddha in our lifetime? With metta. Will you see another Buddha in your lifetime? If you live a very long time, you may see another Buddha, but you have to really extend your life to the maximum. According to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha could extend his life for an eon. So maybe if you extend your life for an eon, yeah, can you do that? It's quite hard. Yeah? It's not easy to extend your life for an eon. And I think it's probably just a mythological thing anyway. I don't really think that's possible, to be perfectly honest. But if you could, then you might be able to hang around until the Buddha, Maitreya, comes around, the next Buddha. Apart from that, I think the answer is no. It's not going to happen in our lifetime. These things, usually they say that a new Buddha only arises when the old Buddha's teaching is gone, yeah, disappeared. And the reason for that is kind of obvious when you think about it. Because if someone is a very sincere spiritual practitioner, which you must be to be able to become the Buddha, if there is already Buddhism in the world, well, you become a Buddhist. Yeah, you just join the existing teaching. You don't need to invent the wheel from scratch. And if you see how our present Buddha, Buddha Gautama, how he lived his life, he started out looking for teachers. Yeah, he went to Alara Kalama Uddaka Ramaputta. These are the two teachers mentioned in the Pali Canon. Also other teachers, because he wanted to learn what was already available as far as spiritual teachings. He wasn't kind of stupid or conceited or full of hubris. The Buddha was quite humble, and he realized, let me learn what can be learned. And so if you follow that process, then of course you will end up being a Buddhist if Buddhism is still around. So it's when Buddhism or the Dhamma has disappeared, that is when a new Buddha will arise. Forget about it. Don't, forget about the next Buddha, because you have no idea when the next Buddha will arise. There have been 28 Buddhas in the past. That's kind of just the mythology. There probably have been innumerable Buddhas in the past, because a Buddha is just a natural phenomenon. Every now and again, someone is able to break through. Someone is able to see the truth of non-self or whatever, and they become a Buddha. And that becomes the basis for the Dhamma to exist in the world. And there is a it's just, and because it is a natural phenomenon, because it's just how the world works, every now and again there will be a Buddha arising in the world. There have been innumerable Buddhas in the past, and there will be probably innumerable Buddhas in the future. But now we have the Buddha Gautama, and that is what is interesting. Take that opportunity now, because next time the Buddha comes around, who knows where you will be and what you will be doing and how deluded you're going to be. Will you recognize the Buddha when the Buddha comes? Probably not. How can we recognize the Buddha? It's very hard to recognize. It's not easy to see that. How many people became Buddhist during the lifetime of the Buddha? Not that many. It's easy to be Buddhist now, because now there are so many Buddhists in the world. So now we just become one sheep among sheep. And being a sheep is much easier than to be, much easier to be a white sheep than to be a black sheep. But sometimes you have to be a black sheep, because a black sheep, they go against the stream. They think differently. They don't go off the cliff when everyone else goes off the cliff. The black sheep, they survive. They turn around before the cliff arrives. And the Buddha, in many ways, I like to think, sometimes maybe this is a bit, I don't know if this is the right way of putting it, but the Buddha is a bit like a black sheep sometimes. He thinks differently. He goes against the stream. And that is difficult. So now is the opportunity, and now is the chance to make progress on this path. And don't do like many other people think, I'm going to hang around and wait for the next Buddha. Usually that's just an excuse, because you cannot really find the motivation to practice. Anyway, all right. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for your guided death contemplation sermon last night. This is my favorite meditation topic. I did one in the morning yesterday, but your sermon has made something clear to me. I had no problem with letting go of my possessions, career, status, even family, but my issues are I haven't done enough in terms of being kind and good. And I do the usual, keep the five precepts and try to be kind to others. But I don't think I go far enough, especially this perspective on seeing people as preconditioned and have compassion for them. So the usual criticism and skepticism at others' words and actions prevail. I'm not in despair, but I am discouraged as I realize I still have a long way to go. Wonderful that you make these discoveries. Every time we make a discovery about ourselves, about what we shall improve, it is wonderful. Don't be discouraged, because this here, what you're doing is that you are finding the treasures within, and you're opening up the possibilities. So this is good news, yeah, when you see these things. And it is one of those things, I think you're absolutely right. It is this ability to be kind at all times, to be generous at all times, to live a life of service and these things. This is really what the path is about. And the more we can do that, we are opening up the possibilities for everything else. And when you do the death meditation and you let go of everything, you have something left. And what you have left is a good feeling about yourself. It's like a warm glow within, because you know that you are living well. And that is what matters. And that is what you take with you into your new life. So it is this ability to really understand the significance of morality, of compassion, of metta, of service, of kindness, of generosity, all the time. Yeah, this ability. And as I mentioned before, sometimes I get really inspired when I see people living the monastic life or lay life so well. Yeah, it's with such incredible devotion and service. And there are some people who are just have this enormous devotional service, and it's such a beautiful thing to see when you see that. And sometimes these people, they are really good meditators, and you can see why, because their whole life they do service with a smile on their face. They never really complain, and it's just marvelous to behold when you see that. And I feel inspired, and I want to be more like that myself. Sometimes I feel I'm not really measuring up. Even as a monk, I kind of sort of should be more service-oriented sometimes. I should do more. I don't know exactly what, but sometimes I feel like I'm missing out sometimes on the opportunities. Every time you open your mouth, it is an opportunity to give a gift to other people. Every word you say can either be a gift or it can be something that is not so nice. It is where you're coming from. It is how you're saying it. It is the mannerism of everything that really matters. And the same thing for how we treat other people in our daily life. Everything can become an act of service if we do things in the right way. Your thoughts can be an act of service. Your meditation can be an act of service for the world because of your attitude. So this is how... So it's wonderful that you are discovering this, because it means that you are gradually... You're going somewhere. If you didn't discover these things, you would be stuck. All right. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for your beautiful teachings. Wish you all happiness, healthy and delighted on your awakening journey. Lots of love to Ajahn and all the beautiful people I met at this retreat. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What a wonderful note. Yeah. And so it's nice to kind of get the nice spread of these beautiful notes throughout the retreat. People really rejoicing in being here. So great. I'll put that one to one side. Dear Ajahn, am I correct to say that wrong samadhi is the samadhi that is not based on right view? There are many meditation teachers of other sects and religions claim that they can get into jhana, but without the basis of right view, one is not possible to see the true nature of things. Am I right? Thanks. Yes, that is exactly right. So wrong samadhi is... can be the similar kind of attainment in terms of bliss and stillness and all of these kind of things. Yeah, you are really having a good time in one way, but the view is not right. And so you mistake the samadhi for something more than it actually is. You take it to be something permanent, an eternal essence or something like that. And this is part of the problem, and this is when you stop making progress on the path. And this is also one of the problems if we take the jhanas to be less than they actually are. Yeah, if you think that the jhana is when you have a bit of peace, you have a bit of joy and happiness. In other words, you haven't really attained the full jhana experience yet. That means that if you take something less to be the real jhana, then when you eventually do get to the real jhana, what are you going to make of it? And well, what you're going to make of it is sometimes you say this is awakening, this is nibbana, this is kind of what it is. And so the whole thing gets distorted because you misunderstand the lower levels on the path. And so it is actually significant and important to try to understand these teachings in the right way, because if you don't, you are not going to be able to take these things all the way. It is interesting, you wonder, why do people take a jhana experience or a samadhi experience to be some sort of eternal reality, some sort of eternal truth, like a god or a permanent consciousness or a permanent mind? Why does that happen? And the reason why it happens is because the sense of self is so powerful. It will create things out of nothing. It will magically make a self out of an experience that you have in samadhi. Because that survival instinct, the drive to survive, is so important in human beings. The will to exist, etc. This is the problem. But if you think about it, there is no experience that can be the counterpart to eternalism or something that lasts for eternity. If you have a samadhi experience, the samadhi experience has a beginning and it has an end. If you say that that reflects an eternal God or an eternal consciousness or an eternal anything, you are adding to that experience. There is no experience that is the counterpart to eternalism or something that lasts eternally. Anything, when you say that something is eternal or something is outside of time and space, you're adding to the experience. It's a figment of the imagination. It is man-made. It is not actually an experience. And this is very interesting, and because the Buddha is a pragmatist, he doesn't really speculate in what might be true and might not be true. He just goes with his experiences that cannot really be a Buddhist teachings. Eternalism doesn't make any sense from Buddhist point of view, because it's something that can never be known. It's impossible to know. That kind of is very, very interesting here. So, but what can be known is cessation, the ending of things. And that is why Buddhism is always about cessation and the ending of things. Okay, next one. Does the word Arya Savaka also have a more general meaning, like Arya Pugala, or does it always refer only to enlightened beings? If it does, are we all Arya Savakas in a more general sense of being disciples of the Buddha? Who then is the Puttacchana? The thing is that many of these words are not used entirely consistently in the suttas. So the word Arya Savaka will normally mean someone who is a noble person, someone who is a stream enterer or more. That is kind of the usual meaning, but not always. And sometimes it is used in a looser sense. So you have to be a little bit sort of open to the context. Yeah, the context matters. Everything has meaning according to context. All words are like that. But generally speaking, you are right. The Arya Savaka is contrasted to the Puttacchana. Puttacchana is the ordinary person. Puttu means many. Jhana is person, like the many person, the ordinary person of the world. These are the two contrasting people, Aryas and Puttacchanas. So that is the general truth, but again, context is what really is matters with these things. Dear Ajahn, is Brahma Sahampati a reincarnation of Gatikara the potter? Thanks. And why do some people chant verses relating to Brahma Sahampati before a monk gives a Dhamma talk? Yeah, thanks again. Yes, these are very good questions. Is Brahma Sahampati a reincarnation of Gatikara the potter? No, I don't think so. Brahma Sahampati is also mentioned as having some previous life, but that was not Gatikara the potter. I think Gatikara the potter also recurs somewhere. He was reborn in some kind of Anagami realm, and I think he is mentioned in the Devata Sanyuta somewhere. They seem to be two different beings. So anyway, Why do we chant verses relating to Brahma Sahampati before the monks give a Dhamma talk? Well, the idea there is to invite the devas to the Dhamma talk. Yeah? It's a kind of traditional chant done in Buddhist countries. Before you give a Dhamma talk, you invite the devas and say, please come and listen to the Dhamma. Yeah? This is your chance. So that is kind of the idea behind that. Does it work? Do any devas actually come? Don't know. Maybe ask Ajahn Brahm, see what Ajahn Brahm says. Do the devas come when you do the devas chant and you invite them? See what he says. It's hard to really say. Usually if the devas are around, presumably they will know and they will just come on their own accord. I don't know if they need to be invited. I don't think they're that shy. Yeah, they will probably come regardless. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, thank you for giving us the wonderful gift of the Dhamma through this sutta retreat. I consider myself very fortunate to have attended one of your retreats last year, which really sparked an interest to read the sutta like Ajahn Brahmali. Okay? The more acquainted I've become with the suttas, the more beautiful and amazing do the teachings start to appear, and the more clear the path forward. Big heartfelt thank you for your influence in my befriending of the suttas. I hope many more people are inspired to delve into the regular readings of the suttas and gradually see what a true spiritual genius the Buddha was. A huge thanks to Christina, Norlia and Lehar for all their amazing work behind the scenes. Your generous and kind conduct truly inspires me to do the same. Finally, a big thanks to the printer for giving everyone the opportunity to read more suttas. Okay, so that's good. So the printing of the suttas is appreciated. Okay, wonderful. So more notes of thanks. We are doing very well, which is great. Dear Ajahn, Ajahn Brahm always mentions the word disappearing. What is its Pali equivalent word? Do the suttas use the word disappearing to describe the state of enlightenment or nibbana? Many thanks. Disappearing is, could be two words. There's two words in the suttas that kind of touch on this. One is viraga and one is niroda. And viraga means like fading away. So it's a gradual diminishing of things. And it gradually diminishes stage by stage until eventually things cease. And cease is then the cessation, is then the full disappearance. So gradual diminishing and then disappearance. This happens in meditation practice. The gradual disappearing happening in meditation, things ceasing and disappearing. And as they do that, you can gain insight into them, because that is what cessation is like, the highest kind of impermanence, when they disappear. And that's when you gain insight into things. So this is the idea of disappearance. So this happens in meditation. It also happens when you eventually, if you're an arahant and you die, you kind of gradually, you disappear completely, and you kind of get extinguished. And this is why extinguishment is a good word for what happens to the arahant after they die. They disappear completely. The state of enlightenment, is that disappearing? State of enlightenment is this disappearing of the sense of self. So you don't have a sense of self anymore. You don't really feel in terms of I am and these kind of things. But you are still there. You haven't disappeared. The five khandhas are still there. You're still living in the world. And then the final disappearance happens when you die as an arahant. All right. Dear Ajahn, awesome, awesome, awesome. Thank you and much gratitude for the marvelous teaching. So inspiring. I am done with the sensual world. Wow, that's pretty good. Okay, well then. Only one goal now, the path to Nibbana. Could you kindly explain the difference between Cetu Vimutti and Panya Vimutti? Much metta to you, Ajahn. Okay, Cetu Vimutti and Panya Vimutti. All right, so these are words that you find in the suttas, and very often you see them together. And vimutti, or vimukta, as you have here, vimutti means liberation, and cetu means the mind, and panya means wisdom. So this one is liberation of the mind, and the other one is liberation through wisdom. And liberation of the mind is just the general, what happens when the mind is free from the defilements. The mind feels liberated. It feels like you're taking away the slaves in the mind, the torturers in the mind are gone. And that is why it is liberated from those defilements. And the mind is clear and bright, and there's no sense of being oppressed anymore. The defilements are an oppression in the mind, and that's why the mind is not liberated. So Chetavimutti, for example, can mean attaining a state of jhana, or a state of the immaterial attainments, or a statement of the Brahma-viharas, if they are practiced fully, like metta and karuna. These are all Chetavimuttis. Panyavimutti is liberation by wisdom. That comes from insight. And it is the insight that leads, that is arahantship in particular, is panya vimutti. So when you have the full insight into the three characteristics and how they relate to the mind and the body, mind specifically, that full insight is called panya vimutti. You are liberated through wisdom, through insight. And when you are an arahant, you have both Chetavimutti and Panyavimutti. You have Panyavimutti because you're liberated through insight, but one of the consequences of being liberated through insight is that the defilements are destroyed. So you have always Chetavimutti once you become an arahant. And that's why in the suttas, you become an arahant, it specifically says you have attained the Chetavimutti and the Panyavimutti. All arahants are both Chetavimutti and Panyavimutti. And there's something called the Ubhatubhaga Vimutti. That is liberated in both ways. And that is both being an arahant and also having attained the very deepest states of samadhi called the immaterial attainments. And that is the Ubhatubhaga Vimutti. So these are the various kinds of liberation that you attain on the path. So there you are. So these are kind of some of the like technical terminology that you find in the suttas. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your inspiring teaching. It's wonderful to listen to your explanations. Lovely to see the nuns also joining here. Many thank you to Lehar. I think you mean Lehar. You haven't got the spelling quite right, but anyway, it's good enough. Christina and Norlia for their hard work. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That is great. Wonderful. So we put that once to one side. This is, I don't know if I told you, I think I told you before, that Ajahn Brahm, he used to, when he got thank you notes, Ajahn Brahm used to get lots of letters saying, oh, thank you so much, you saved my life, and these kind of things. And he would stack them. He had a special cabinet in his room, and he would put all of these letters into that cabinet. And whenever the work of being the abbot became a bit arduous and difficult, he would take out one of those letters and read them, and he would feel good again. And he would feel, oh, okay, good, people do appreciate me after all. So this is what we do with these notes. We put them to one side, and then when we get a bit depressed in our kuti, we bring them out, and we read them, and then we're happy. So it's smart, isn't it? It's kind of really, that's wisdom, that's very practical wisdom for you right there. Okay, dear Ajahn, question number one. Oh, there's many questions, okay. Majjhimanika 128, what happened to the quarreling monks who declined the Buddha's help? Did they sort themselves out as the end, at the end, or the Buddha was the mediator? What is the moral of that story? So what happened is that, and that story is found in the Vinaya Pitaka, and that's where the kind of the consequent actions are all recorded. And what happened is that the lay people in Kosambi were really fed up with the monks arguing so much. So the lay people said, we're not going to support the monks anymore. So they stopped giving them requisites and all these kind of things. Then the monks kind of came to their senses very quickly, because if you don't get to eat for a few days, it kind of, your stomach tells you that, okay, better do something about this. And so they decided then, okay, let's sort this out. So they traveled to Sarvati, which when the Buddha went to Sarvati later on, and they went to Sarvati and they kind of went there to sort everything out and ask for forgiveness and et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of how it ended up. Yeah, so it ended up well in a sense. So the Buddha, was the Buddha a mediator? The Buddha was kind of in the background giving instructions for how it was to be sorted out. So the moral of that story is that, what is the moral of the story? The moral of the story is that, I don't know, the moral, people are stupid. No. I don't know. The moral of the story is that this is what we can expect in the world, I suppose. Yeah, you can always expect problems, even in the monastic community, and that you need to. We need to do our very best to sort these things out. Yeah, find a way through. And there is a way, and the Buddha has actually laid down. And one of the advantages of having these kind of events happening at the time of the Buddha is that the Buddha then had a chance to lay down procedures for how to emerge from those problems. And these are very serious problems, because what happened here is that you almost had a split in the Sangha, what is called Sangha Beda, like a schism in the Sangha. And Sangha Beda is considered one of the most serious things that can happen in Buddhism. And so you really want to avoid that. So there are very clear procedures of how to come together and sort out these problems. This is kind of the advantage of having had these things happen at the time of the Buddha. But the moral, I guess, is that the world is uncertain. The world is unreliable. Monks and nuns are going to argue with each other sometimes. Buddhism is going to decline. Before you know it, it's gone. It's all impermanent, unreliable, uncertain. Now is the time to practice. That is the moral of the story here. Yes? So that is always the moral, I think. The moral is always that things are just so uncertain and so unreliable. And now is the time. You never know when the time will come again. Question number two. We have been learning all the drawbacks of the sensual pleasures. For a layperson, what are the list of those sensual pleasures we should tackle one after another? The most important thing is just to know yourself when you have certain attachments in that realm. But some of the most important problems are the attachments to that world, right? Doesn't matter so much if you have a nice meal and you enjoy the meal. That is not a big problem. The problem is, again, if you kind of think about food a lot, that's when it is a problem. That's when you have a problem of attachment. The problem is when you find that you cannot let go of the body and the five senses because you are generally attached to the world of the five senses. Yeah, you want to experience that world. It is important to you to experience that world. And because you want to experience that world, you cannot really let go. That is the problem. And so instead of kind of trying to reflect on specific issues in that world, sometimes it is more useful to remember, have a kind of global view of the problems of the sense pleasures. And one of the perceptions that I like in the suttas is the perception called the Sabbaloke Anabiratti Sanya, which means the perception of non-delight in the whole world. And the whole world here refers to the world of the five senses. So you understand that the whole world of the five senses is so incredibly flawed. It is so utterly out of control. It is always going to let you down, always going to cause you suffering in the end. Everything in the five sense world ends in tears. This is the problem. You're going to die one day. Everything that you love in that world is going to have to go. This is what it means by it kind of ends in tears. And all relationships must end. All ownership will be challenged by the impermanence of the world. All status that you have, all the building up of your ego is going to be challenged by the world. So everything in that world is so utterly unreliable. Your body is unreliable, right? The cancers may just be waiting to come out in your body here. And so because of all of that, you just turn away from that whole world. You realize how useless it is, that there is much higher happiness to be attained on the spiritual path, and you go for that instead, and you let go of that world. That is really, to my mind, the kind of a good way of thinking about that world, having a global view, not focusing on specific pleasures, but having the sense that that world is not very interesting, and then gradually withdrawing from that world. And it makes you a better person. The less attachments you have, the less involvement you have in the five sense world, the more clarity you have in your mind, and the more you can actually make good decisions, kind decisions. You can have more compassion for other people without the vested interest of attachment. And so you become more clear. So it's kind of the paradox. The less attachment you have, the better you become as a person. And that's kind of what is interesting about this. So just remember the general problems of the sensual world. I didn't include the Potalya Sutta on this retreat, but I usually love to discuss the Potalya Sutta because it has these seven similes on the problems of sensual pleasures. The simile of the borrowed goods, yeah? One of the really nice ways of thinking about the sensory world. Everything is borrowed. It will only last for a short time. How do you treat borrowed goods? If everything that world is borrowed, how do you relate to it? And you relate to it in a very different way from things that you own. Yeah, and you don't own anything. So we think we own it, but actually we borrow things. So what does that mean? If you borrow or you rent an apartment, or you borrow or you rent a car, it's very different from owning a car. And we should relate to everything in our life as borrowed things. The simile of the dream, yeah, that everything in the sensory world is like a dream. It's like a dream of a certain reality that never turns out to be true. It always lets you down instead. The simile of the piece of meat, the idea that, you know, we're always fighting over things in that world. It is inherently violent and full of conflict, the world of the five senses. The fact that that world never provides any real satisfaction. This is a simile of the dog and the bone. Yeah, the dog which kind of gets hold of a bone, but you know, chewing a bone doesn't really lead to any real satisfaction. Chewing the bone just gives you a little bit of taste of the blood that is on the bone, and that's about it. And then you kind of, the craving is really unabated, and you carry on craving more, and you run on to your next bone. And then in the meantime, you die, and then when you get reborn, you kind of carry on looking for these stupid bones. And you never get anywhere. No real satisfaction, no real contentment, nothing really happens, right? And this is the problem. The satisfaction happens when you practice the Dhamma, when you become content, when you're watching the breath, you're not thinking of anything else in the whole world, just really happy with the breath, experience a bit of joy, a bit of happiness. That is when you start to understand what real happiness is to be found. The world of craving is always unsatisfactory because you're always moving on to something else. You're never really happy with what you've got. And it's endless. And we, for some reason, we foolishly carry on in that world. And one of the reasons is because we don't know the alternative. All right, so there you are. Oh, okay. So I'll just go for the shorter one first. Thank you so much for emphasizing developing mindfulness before sitting in meditation. This has borne real fruit for me in this retreat. Your very words have taken me further along the path. What a wonderful thing that is. I'm very, very happy to hear that because this is the sort of thing that I have been taught by Ajahn Brahm. It took me a long time to get it, but so I'm glad that other people are seeing it in the same way. So that's great. Okay, so now the last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, I am so very fortunate to be here on the retreat at Jhana Grove with such wonderful spiritual companions, such as all these retreatants and monastics. It is indeed a gain for us to have you as a teacher, Lehar, Scotty, Christina, Nolia, and others who help run Jhana Grove so well. It is also amazing how many wise and learned people there are here. Like taking your car to get serviced, we have all brought our minds to be reconditioned by the Buddha and our views realigned with the Dhamma. Excellent. That's really good. But still some questions. Okay, I thought it was going to be all praise, but actually there's some questions as well. So here we go. So the questions. It seems that the Buddha and Ajahn Brahm took some time to break through to seeing clearly despite practicing the jhanas. Is this what is meant by how for some people samatha comes first and then vipassana, whilst others may not have jhana so easily, but when they do, the insight they will come quickly? What then is the path where both develop together? All right, so it's very difficult to know. The Buddha seems to have happened fairly quickly, once he had the jhanas, the kind of the rest happened fairly fast afterwards. He just had to remember his past lives. It didn't seem to take that long. I don't know, I just get the impression from the suttas, maybe a few weeks or maybe a few months or something. It wasn't that long. One of the things about the Buddha is that he became like an arahant, became the Buddha straight away. He does not seem to have gone through the stages of stream entry, etc. And of course, that means you need more samadhi to be able to make such a powerful breakthrough all at once. It needs a very, very powerful mind. So you probably need to develop the jhanas more. You need to remember your past lives. You need to understand the laws of karma and all of these kind of things. And then you gather together all that information, and then when it all kind of comes together, then in one kind of one powerful moment, everything just explodes, and bang, you become fully enlightened as a consequence, and the world turns upside down, and you see things, everything in a new way as a consequence. So I think it didn't take that long for the Buddha. As for Ajahn Brahm, it is very hard to really be very specific about it, but it does, you know, he does seem to have had jhanas very early on in his life, but I think early on he didn't have very clear teachings about Buddhism, so he probably didn't really know exactly what he was doing. Yeah, so practicing jhanas, having some success, but not having very good guidance. And that lack of guidance may have led to maybe it taking more time. Yeah, it's really, really hard to say. I don't know exactly what the kind of how these things happened. Well, I have some idea, but not, you know, it's hard to really say. And so, but once you have really good information about how to contemplate, how to deal with the jhanas after you come out, then I think it will happen very quickly as a consequence, especially when those jhanas are really deep. When the Buddha talks about samatha and vipassana, and sometimes it calls sammata pubbangama vipassama, something like that, which means that sammata comes first and then vipassana afterwards. Other times it's vipassana first, then sammata, and sometimes together. It's important to realize this is kind of just a relative difference. It is not an absolute difference. Yeah, so it means that maybe when you focus on vipassana, it may just be that you contemplate things, you contemplate impermanence, yeah, you see the danger of the five senses, you understand the danger of the world, you see the dukkha around you, so you contemplate the nature of the world, and then that leads to clarity about the world, and then that leads to peace, that leads to samatha, because whenever you see things clearly, calm always comes with it. And then the other way is that, you know, you're just watching your breath and you become peaceful. And then when you become peaceful, you come out of that state of watching the breath and you will see things clearly. Yeah, why? Because you are peaceful. The two things always go together. They're not really separate. It's just a kind of difference in emphasis. That is all there really is. And this is a very important point. There is a little booklet called Why Samatha and Vipassana Are Inseparable. And this is something that is based on a talk that I gave a long time ago. You can find it online if you want to check it out. And it gives the argument for why these things come together. In the suttas, they're always mentioned together. It's always called Samatha Vipassana, like one word, as if they are inseparable. And of course, they are inseparable. Why are they inseparable? And it's not that hard to understand. The reason they are inseparable is because the cause for samatha is the same as the cause for vipassana. Why do you feel calm? The reason you feel calm is because the defilements are going down. If you have a lot of defilements in your mind, ill will or desire or whatever, your mind is restless. Desire always propels you into the future. It's about finding happiness somewhere else. It's about going somewhere. It is restless by its very nature. Anger is restless by its nature, because you're thinking about someone and you are upset about it and you are kind of looking into the past or whatever. It's a restless state of mind. But when the defilements go down, the more they go down, the more peaceful you feel. So defilements are the problem. And the result of reducing defilements is that you become peaceful. But when it comes to vipassana, it's exactly the same thing. When long as there is defilements in the mind, it's impossible to see things clearly. Why? Because you have a vested interest in things. If you have strong desires, you cannot see the object of those desires clearly, because the desire hinders clarity. The desire gives you a sense that this is important to you, and for that reason you can't see things clearly. Exactly the same thing with anger. If you are angry at someone, you can't see them clearly. What you will see is you will focus on the negative aspects of that person. You see them in a biased way. So vipassana can only happen when the defilements go down. So you can see the cause for vipassana is the same as the cause for samatha. Both require the reduction in defilements. The more you reduce the defilements, you will therefore have the more samatha you will have and the more vipassana you will have. So if your meditation is successful and the defilements go down, it has two results, samatha and vipassana. And this is why everything in Buddhism is about one thing, and that is the reduction of the defilements of the mind. This is why we have talked about that at such length during this retreat. All the little defilements, all the things that you have to give up. This is why the Noble Eightfold Path is the path of purification, the Visuddhimagga, because it actually purifies the mind. When that mind is purified, it has two results, samatha and vipassana, clear seeing and calm. There's a very important addition to this, which I think people often don't maybe underestimate. How do we measure our success in meditation? Vipassana is a very difficult way to measure your success because you don't really know your vipassana. You don't know how much insight you have. Insight is not very tangible. Sometimes you may feel that you have deep insight, but how deep is it actually? It's hard to measure against anything else. You don't really have any standard. But calm is relatively easy to understand. We can all know the degree to which we are calm, and the standards in the suttas are fairly clear. You want to have the one-pointedness of mind. You know about staying with the breath. You know about the nimittas, the lights and the shapes in the mind. So you have an idea. You have a standard by which you can measure calm. It's more easy to measure than insight or clear seeing. And so I would say that if you want to measure the progress in your meditation, use the degree of calm that you have, the degree of stillness that you have, as a guidance for how well you are doing. And that will give you guidance both for how much vipassana you have and also for how much samatha you have, because both go together. So if you think that you have a lot of vipassana, well, if you really do, the samatha should be quite powerful. If you have a lot of samatha, your vipassana will also be quite good, because they go together. So there isn't really any absolute distinction between the two. There's just a kind of a slight degree of emphasis in difference here. And then the last way is when samatha and vipassana go together. You do a little bit of contemplation, you do a little bit of samatha practice, watching the breath, and it kind of grows very evenly in this way. So this is really how these things work. This is how I see it, and I think this is also born out of the suttas. The suttas that talk about vipassana going before samatha are actually very, very few in number. There's a few in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, the fours. That's where you find the suttas, and there's only about three or four suttas that talk about this thing. Other suttas don't talk about it at all. All they talk about is just meditation. And if you meditate, watch the breath. What are you doing? You're doing both samatha and vipassana. Why? Because you're overcoming the defilements of the mind, and it leads to both those results. That's really all you have to worry about. Practice the sila, the kindness, the morality. Watch the breath, and that is the entire Buddhist path. Comes down to those two very, very simple things. And it will give you all the samatha, all the vipassana that you need to go all the way to the end of the path. Okay, so that is all for tonight. As always, we're coming fairly close now to the end of the retreat. There's only another day and a half to go or so. So please keep on enjoying yourself to the very end. And I wish you, as always, a very good night rest. And we'll see you back again tomorrow morning here.